ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tayari Jones was already an established writer when she published An American Marriage in 2018. But it was with that book that she reached a whole new level of fame. That novel, about a relationship upended by a wrongful imprisonment, it won her the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2019. An American Marriage was very much about the current moment. But for her follow-up, Tayari Jones is looking back to her mother's generation, taking us to the segregated American South in the 1950s and 60s. This is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. I'm Claire Nichols, and the reality TV fan in me is very excited to bring you a conversation with an American Survivor player turned novelist later. But first, it's Tayari Jones and her beautiful novel, Kin. Kin is about two motherless girls, Niecy and Annie. They grow up together, they call themselves cradle friends, but their lives pull them in wildly different directions. Tayari Jones, it's great to have you back on The Book Show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here to talk to you again.
I always remember talking to you about how An American Marriage started, because it famously started with you eavesdropping on a couple. I think it was in a food court.
Yes.
Where did Kin begin?
It kind of is the opposite experience in that I was contracted to write a contemporary novel about the way the city of Atlanta has changed. And I was trying to write that novel, but I didn't have any traction. Like, I could feel myself working. And when the writing is going well, it's like I feel myself floating. And I was not floating, I was working. And after a couple of years, I just started writing on a piece of paper with a pencil, not even a pen, a pencil, and just writing to see what my mind could produce. And I started writing these characters set in the 1950s. And I said, well, maybe these are the parents of my real characters, because I am not a historical novelist. So, And then after about a year, and I was 150 pages in, I said, okay, this is not backstory. This is the story.
So how do you have that conversation then of going, you know, I was contracted to write a contemporary novel. This is what I actually have for you.
Oh, I didn't mention it. I just completed it, and I just completed it and sent it in. And my editor said that she had to have her assistant pull the contract, because she thought, am I going crazy? Someone's going crazy. And it turned out that it was me that had gone crazy.
Talk to me about this act of writing with a pencil, not even a pen. What difference does that make to the process?
Well, you know, I feel like machines become a mediator between your mind and the page. And because I was having such terrible writer's block, I wanted to feel the way I felt when I was a child writing. Mm. And when I was a child, I wrote with a pencil on, you know, a piece of notebook paper. And that's what I did. I just had to really, really try and get back to basics.
Okay, before we get into the story of Kin, I want to talk a little bit about the setting, because our characters are growing up in a place called Honeysuckle, Louisiana. This is the American South. This is in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, this is such an important moment in American history, right kind of at the end of the Jim Crow era, right?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, this is the generation of my parents. In some ways, I feel almost as though my parents are immigrants to a different life, because they did grow up in segregated smaller towns in the South, and I grew up in Atlanta post-segregation in a big city. Mm-hmm. So I feel like my parents are from a different world, not only like a different landscape, but kind of like a different emotional scape, a different political scape. And so I think in many ways, this is my attempt to understand how I came to be by understanding how they grew up. What are the stories they never told? My parents are not forthcoming people. They're both social scientists. They do not do emotion.
And your mum was quite a famous person from this era, right? Barbara Posey. She was part of this famous sit-in. Can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that my mother did participate in a sit-in movement, which was actually far before the more well-known movements. And I think that the contribution, she was in Oklahoma, the contribution that they made has kind of gone, in some ways, lost to history. There's been a monument recently erected to honor them. There were about, I would say, 10 kids. My mother was 15. And they went to a drugstore, to a cafe in a drugstore, and they sat in every day in the summer, Monday through Saturday. And then when school was in, they did it on the weekends for 2 years. Like they just, these kids were just determined that they were going to affect social change by just, I guess I'll just say they just annoyed the hell out of these people because, you know, in Oklahoma, they didn't send in the police. They didn't send in dogs. They just ignored these kids who completely took over the counter every day. It was just like a silent standoff until things changed.
How incredible. Is that something your mom would talk about? Is that a story she would share?
No, my mother doesn't really share stories. My mother is an economist by trade. She will draw you a graph or something, but she's not going to really tell you a story. I've actually learned more about it in the last, say, 5 or 6 years, or maybe 10 years, because she has been honored for her contributions, and she's kind of told me stories. And I went on this incredible hunt to find a copy of a magazine in which she was featured. And I finally found it on eBay for just $2. And I gave it to her, and she was moved to tears because she never thought she would see that magazine again. But she got to fly on an airplane, go to address the NAACP youth to encourage other young people to do, you know, civil disobedience in their towns. Because the idea was to have little fires everywhere until they all came together, you know, to change the country.
I'm starting to wonder where you came from, Tayari, how this storyteller emerged from these two economists
who
don't
people.
Like to tell stories.
I think perhaps that is how I emerged, because my parents, daddy is a political scientist and my mother is an economist, and neither of them is really into literature. I think that's an understatement, but it gave me space to develop kind of in an unbothered way, because I never associated my writing with trying to please my parents or have their approval. It was something that I could do just for myself. And I think that really helped me grow as an artist to explore my imagination, my creativity with no pressure at all. It was the sweet bliss of invisibility.
Okay. So, and Tayari, you've said you don't consider yourself a writer of historical fiction. Obviously, confronting this particular moment in American history, this almost completely different time to what you know, was it confronting to go back to these stories and that this, you know, this discrimination that existed at this time?
You know, the hard thing for me was, one, accepting that this was, in fact, my subject matter. Because as a writer, I was very dedicated to the contemporary story because I felt that there was kind of an undue pressure on Black writers that you're supposed to like correct the record. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, hell, if I'm writing my mother's story, then what, my daughter would write my story, you know, and so on and so on. And that no one is better equipped to tell the story of my moment than me. So I kind of had like an ideological drive to write the contemporary story. However, writing this story in the past, it did give me a different kind of, well, I always had compassion. I mean, I guess I knew my parents grew up in Jim Crow and I had compassion. Like my father would sometimes tell the saddest stories in the most offhand way. For example, I wanted to buy a coat from a catalog, and he told me that I shouldn't. And then he told me the sad story about how when he was a boy, he saved and saved and saved for a turtleneck sweater. And he saved his money. And when he finally was able to order it, he discovered that he was allergic to wool. He had never experienced wool, but he couldn't send it back because once a Black person had touched something, it was considered tainted. And so he had to use scissors to cut the neck away. And he was ashamed because it was ragged and unraveling. And he told me the story to say, and so you shouldn't buy from catalogs. You should go to the store. And I thought it was just so sad. And I said, Daddy, that's so terrible. That's so sad. And he shrugged and said, no, just don't order it. And it gave me, I imagine him as a little boy, you know, not my father, but that he had once been a little boy.
So did this project change the way you think about your mom and your dad?
I think it did, but I came to understand why my father told such sad stories in an offhand way, because he grew up in this time, she grew up in this time, but that wasn't all they did. Like, when you hear about people experiencing discrimination, you think they just sit around all day being discriminated against. But no, they have their own agendas, their own feelings, their own, you know, ambitious desires, their own crushes. Like, just writing about people living their full adult, fully realized lives, dealing with questions of sexuality, all of this while Jim Crow is happening, it reminds you that people's inner lives are just as significant, if not more so, than these external factors.
And the inner lives in this novel, Kin, are so rich. Our two main characters are Niecy, or Vernice, and Annie. They're cradle friends. What does that mean?
It means they knew each other when they were just two little babies in a crib. Like, they are as close as sisters because they can't imagine a life before they knew one another.
And they are both motherless girls. They've both grown up without their mums. Can you explain what's happened to these girls?
Well, Vernice, her mother was killed before she turned a year old. Her father killed her mother and then killed himself. So she has grown up her whole life knowing she will never see her mother again. While Annie, her mother ran off and left her when she was just, you know, barely more than a newborn. And so she lives her whole life with this hope that they'll be reunited. I like to think that Annie wakes up every day with hope that maybe she'll meet her mother today, and she goes to bed each night disappointed.
It's so interesting because you'd think that hope is a positive, but actually, in a way, maybe the world has been kinder to Niecy, who knows she will never see her mum, than to Annie, who dreams every day that she might and is then let down.
And not only that, Annie, all real life people have to compete with Annie's imaginary mother. Real people can never compete with our fantasies. And I think that is really, it's the hope and the fantasy that keeps Annie from being able to move forward in her life.
They're both fatherless girls as well, but that doesn't seem to matter too much to either of them. There's a line in the book which says, when you don't have a mother, you don't really know who you are.
I believe that is true, that, you know, our mothers are, in fact, our origin stories. And like, I feel like I've learned a lot about my own life from looking at my mother, and I better understand her choices now that I'm old enough to understand her life. And even that's another thing that was very helpful in writing this book, and that I came to understand, like, the way that women in the 1950s and 60s were kind of told that they were born to marry. That's such a different life. And also the way that women were held hostage by their reproduction. As a person born in 1970, you know, I came of age. By the time I was, you know, an adult, the pill was just part of the culture. That was really more difficult for me to understand than the idea of racial discrimination, was this idea how people were just out here basically rolling the dice on having babies.
Yeah.
And how the idea that unplanned, like, we hear the term planned parenthood, but we don't really think about what that means, that that was such a cultural shift that you could plan to be a parent or not, and how babies would just be in the community and somebody had to take them in. So many people were reared by people who did not plan to do this.
And that's certainly the case for these two girls, Niecy and Annie. They have these women that raise them. Annie is raised by her grandmother. Niecy is raised by her aunt. And these women are dutiful. They do their job. They do a pretty good job. But they're not necessarily loving and over the top and, oh, you're so amazing and, oh, this is the meaning of my life, are they?
It wasn't their plan. I mean, can you imagine? I will tell you, a couple of summers ago, I had to keep an infant in my home for about a month that I wasn't planning to keep in my home. It was a big deal to have that little boy in my house. He was nocturnal. It was, it happened quite suddenly. And I was when I was writing this book. So I think that also influenced my understanding of, you know, the gift that Niecy's aunt gives to rear her, but it was not her plan. And that happens to a lot of children. Like all children need to be loved extravagantly. Mm. But sometimes that extravagant love is just not available. Her aunt did not have it to give.
Yeah. Okay, so the girls grow up. Niecy goes off to college. She's on a path, I guess, to marriage and to security and to all these things that are expected of a young woman in this era. Annie goes in a different direction. Where is Annie headed at this moment in time?
Annie decides that she is going to go to Memphis because she has heard through the grapevine that her mother is there. And so she's a teenager. She hatches this cockamamie scheme with these other kids, and they've got a stolen car, and they're going to drive across the country, a couple states over, to go to Memphis. And they, on the way, they end up having to stay at what I like to call a sharecropping whorehouse, because, you know, they have limited options because they're Black, and that's somewhere that will take them because also they're not married. So, the lady who runs the nice place says, this is not that kind of place. I don't let people stay here if they're not married. And they end up living at this brothel. But I have to say, I always say they worked at the brothel, but as laundry women.
Not that kind of work.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But I had a lot of fun writing. I mean, I like writing these outlaw characters, and I feel like the Madame Lulabelle is such an outlaw.
She is an absolutely fantastic character who actually has some love to give.
She has some love to give, absolutely. But here's the thing. Annie is holding a place in her heart reserved for her long-lost mother. Someone can't take you in and love you like a mother if you won't let them.
Mm. Okay, so Annie's gone in an interesting direction. She's off at the whorehouse. Niecy, meanwhile, going to college. She's got all her perfect underwear on. She is ready to be a proper young lady. I do want to talk about the college. This is Spelman College. This is where you went too.
Indeed.
Oh, you're holding up your Spelman College mug right there. Amazing.
Yes. Yes, Spelman College changed my life. It is a historically Black college for women here in Atlanta. We were founded in 1881 with only 11 students, and our founders had $100.
Wow.
But the thing that I learned about Spelman in my research, I read a book called A Mighty Justice by Dovie Johnson Rountree, who was an attorney in the 60s, and she had gone to Spelman. And what I didn't know, even though I am a graduate of Spelman College, and as a first-year student, I was class historian. So I thought I knew all there was to know. But so many of the women who went there in the early years worked like full-time as maids to pay their way through school. I have a woman in my life who's 97, and she's a graduate, and she told me how she came to Spelman with all of the money that her family was able to put together in a sock. She had a sock full of coins, and she presented this to the president of the college, who poured the money out of the sock, returned the sock, because this lady needed the sock, and asked her where would she live, and she said she was going to stay with a relative who was going to let her sleep on the couch. And the president said, I think you would be better served by living in the dormitory. And she had never heard of a dormitory. And so this little country girl that came with a sock full of money grew up to have a PhD in Shakespeare.
Wow.
So people associate these colleges with kind of serving the Black bourgeoisie, but really they kind of created a Black middle class by offering opportunity and education.
So Niecy is on this path. She's in the dormitory, and in her dormitory is this other woman, and the two of them form this incredible bond. They fall in love.
Indeed.
And I found this aspect of the book so fascinating because Niecy never really names what this is or what she is. You know, she doesn't say, I'm gay, I'm a lesbian, I'm in love.
They don't even have the words.
That's what I wanted to ask. How is this just a matter of the time that the language isn't there? Or is this almost a denial in herself of this is just a moment in time and I am headed on a different path?
I think it's both. I do believe she has a model in her hometown, these eccentric ladies that live together, but she doesn't want to return to her small hometown. She says, I didn't come all the way here to go home and be some kind of eccentric.
I understand, Tayari Jones, that this was kind of a tricky book for you. There were a few things going on. One of them was you had some health challenges while writing Kin.
Yes, I got very sick. I've never been sick before. And like over a period of like 2 months, I went from being a normal person to being so sick that I could hardly walk. I was diagnosed with Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune disorder. It comes out of nowhere. And I was having trouble seeing. Like now I'm wearing glasses. I didn't wear glasses before. It damaged my vision. But I had to write much of this book wearing an eye patch.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, and I use the computer. I normally write on my typewriters, but I had to use the computer because I needed help. I just, you can't really write it on a Smith Corona with an eye patch. It's just too much. And so the characters kept me company. I'm so happy that I had them with me during my sickness. They gave me something to do, something to think about besides thinking about how well I wasn't.
Mm. You really can't see the struggle on the page. The writing is so beautiful in this novel. And it does feel like, you know, you're talking about right at the start that you were floating when you wrote this. It really does seem to just sing. Can you see the struggle on the page? Can you see the blood, sweat, and tears that went into this?
No, actually, because I feel like I was having a hard time in my life because I was sick and all these things, but I wasn't having a hard time with the characters. Like they were there for me during this, and it gave me, I could wake up in the morning, and even if I wasn't feeling well, I knew I had something to do. I had to find out what was going to happen. Like, how on earth is Annie going to get out of this sharecropping whorehouse? She can't stay there for the rest of the book. And so I was curious to see what was going to happen. And, you know, she was in love, and I enjoyed being a spectator. I felt like I was, in many ways, a spectator to this book. And I had to accept that and not feel in control of it. And I think I didn't feel in control of it because at that time I didn't feel in control of my life. I mean, when you realize the frailty of the body, you realize how little you control. I'm much better now, though. I want to say I feel fine.
I'm so pleased to hear that. I have been kind of waxing lyrical about the writing in this book because I think it's glorious. I was hooked from the first page. And I hope this is okay to say, Tayari, but there's something almost old-fashioned about the way you have approached this novel. It is in first person. It is in past tense. You're not doing lots of fancy stuff with this. It is good old-fashioned storytelling. And I was wondering, were you deliberately harking back to a different generation of novelist with this book?
Well, I think I felt like the characters are so vivid and so lively. These people are... something else. These characters, like every character, I think has what my students call main character energy. Like every character feels like if this was a television show, they could each have a spinoff.
Yes.
So when you have all of these things going on, you don't want the structure of the book to announce itself or distract. We have enough to keep track of with these 10 or so really, I want to say very Southern characters.
They are characters that I loved in a book that I adored. It is called Kin. It is by Tayari Jones. It's published by Penguin. What a pleasure to chat to you again today.
It was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Do you watch reality TV? And if you do, how sophisticated a viewer do you consider yourself to be? Can you see the fingerprints of the show's producers, those people behind the scenes guiding the action and choosing what we, the audience, actually see? Stephen Fishback is a writer who knows reality TV better than most. He first appeared on the American version of Survivor in 2009, and he was the self-declared nerd, the strategy guy who eventually became the runner-up and a fan favourite, and he was voted into a return season in 2015. Now Stephen Fishback has released his first novel. It's called Escape, and naturally it's about a reality show on an island. But in this game, the rules are looser, the stakes are higher, and the producers will go to any lengths, and I mean any lengths, to create groundbreaking TV. Now, I should declare I am a big, big, big Survivor fan, so this is exciting for me. Stephen Fishback, welcome to The Book Show.
It's such an honor to be here.
And I think it's so amazing because in 2025, there really is this whole kind of population of ex-reality TV contestants out there. I mean, just from American Survivor alone, it's coming up to season 50. There must be hundreds just of people like you, right?
There are hundreds of us, and we all meet up at reality TV charity events and get to recapture for a few moments our former glory while we all swap stories about, you know, either how great we were or how we should have won our seasons. Everybody's got a story about how they really should have been the one to win their season.
Well, I'd love to go back to the start because I think for this novel Escape, it's really important to understand the psychology of the reality TV contestant. So you first appeared in 2009. Who were you, Stephen, when you first auditioned for that show?
Yeah, I was a 28-year-old. I worked at a tech startup and I lived in New York City. And I just had this sense that, you know, I was dissatisfied. I think like a lot of people living in kind of contemporary corporate culture, I like wanted more. I wanted an adventure. I wanted to touch something real that was out there, you know. But I was also a little bit scared about like what adventure to take. You know, I didn't want to strike out boldly into the wilderness because I thought that would end in disaster. And then I actually got an email, a Facebook email that said, "Hey, Stephen, do you want to be on Survivor? Let's make it happen." Yeah. They had already cast their season 18, Token Sheens. And I think they decided that their nerd character was not nerdy enough. And I had a friend who worked in casting and she said, "Oh, I know a real nerd. I've got the nerd for you. If we're looking for a real nerd, like my friend Stephen is nerdy as can be."
Wow. So just an email, I mean, people today would kill for like just an email to come out of the blue to invite you onto Survivor.
I know. It's such a different ecosystem now where I think people there are more super fans now who are desperate to get on the show. Back when I was first on, it was casted largely, you know, they went out seeking certain types of people. Taj George, who was on my season, I think they were specifically looking for an NFL player's wife. And she happened to also be a huge pop star, but like that isn't even why they found her, is because they were looking for an NFL player's wife. Just like such a specific niche thing to be seeking. I was a huge fan of Survivor when it first premiered, but when I got that email, I honestly didn't even know it was still on the air. And I went back and watched these seasons, and I'm a big gamer. I love strategy games. So watching it, I thought, you know what? I think I could do well on this show. I could even maybe win. And I did well, but I didn't win.
You almost won. You came second, runner-up. But you're a smart guy. Do you not look at a show like that and go, what could this mean for me? How could my story be manipulated? Could this be a dangerous thing for me to do?
Well, I mean, as I was saying, like, you know, I wanted that adventure. So the fact that there would be this CBS medical copter, you know, hovering nearby actually was very, very appealing. But yes, in fact, I had worked at MTV. So I had worked on the corporate side of reality television. And so I knew very well that these shows are very edited. You could be made to look dumb. And that same friend who advised me to go, I said, you know, I don't want to look like an idiot. And he said, I wish these were my own insights. They're just this other guy who was really smart. He said that they're not casting you to be that idiot. You know, they're casting people to be the idiot. And at the time, that was true. At the time, I was cast to be like the nerd gamer. I think now they allow anybody to be the idiot. But at the time, I think I was not cast to be the idiot.
You were portrayed as the strategist, as the smart guy. When you came back and you watched it later, what was that like?
It's so interesting because the experience of being on the show and the experience of watching the show are two totally different things. I mean, I did have that experience being out there in the wilderness, you know, feeling like I was connecting with a different part of myself. And there's something very strange about then watching that transformed into this tightly edited series where a lot of what you do is just left on the cutting room floor. You know, the complicated decisions you have are turned into kind of, you know, bullet pointed ideas. I mean, I got the best of it because I did so well. They end up making, you know, my story a big part of the season. But even so, there was so much more. And like the most meaningful parts, right, which was these human connections, these growth moments, that's not part of the show at all, you know? And so it really is, you kind of have to like come to terms with the idea that the way that millions of people are being introduced to you is not really who you are or in your control at all.
So I guess you have people now who think that they know you, right, Stephen? But they know the Survivor edit of you.
Right. And what's funny too is that I think, and the book deals with this, like, I think I've like become more my Survivor edit, you know? Like, you see yourself on this show, and in some ways that you sort of like take on that identity, that it's become a part of me. You know, I'm like constantly, maybe subconsciously even, performing that identity of the person on the show. As you know, and of course, I'm still myself. I'm still, you know, authentically me. But just part of that crafted person has, you know, grafted onto me.
That's so interesting. In Escape, you write, there are always two games, the one you're playing against the other contestants and the one the producers are playing against you. Can you explain that line?
Yeah, and that comes from my hero, Kent, who is this former contestant. And he too, like, has spent a decade or more, 15 years watching his highlight reel, you know, trying to remember who he was and his past greatness as he's, you know, gone back to reality, like real reality, you know, his sort of dead end job prospects and not living up to who he imagined he might be. And he is someone who, when he finally gets that call to go back, is so hungry for it. But yet, because he's been on the show before, he's also very knowing about it, almost too knowing about the production edifice of it all, mm-hmm. and how you're being pushed and prodded by the producers to act a certain way. And I think that kind of attention to the production leads to almost a paranoia. And I think Kent has that, where he's too tuned in to what the producers are saying, almost at the expense of the actual game in front of him.
So can you give an example of how a producer might influence you, say in the part of a show where the contestant talks to the camera and they talk about how they're feeling and they're clearly talking to a producer? How is that producer prompting them when they go into that conversation?
Honestly, you know, it's all about questions. And that's what's so interesting about these interviews, is that nobody's telling you to do anything. Nobody is saying you have to do this. You know, Kent, this is what I want from you. It's all leading questions. And when, you know, the first time you're out there, you don't see how you're being led. You know, you're just, I'm receiving a question and I'm answering it. I'm telling you what I think, you know, like, hey, Kent, don't you think you need to save your fellow contestant Miriam? And then Kent says, yes, I do need to save my fellow contestant Miriam. And then when you hear yourself say it, you start to think it, you know, it actually affects your thinking because you say it and you hear yourself say it. And then, you know, there's that cognitive dissonance element where, oh, I've just said this thing in this interview, like that must be what I believe. And then that starts to shape your actions and who you are. And I think what's particularly interesting is the way that producers can kind of dangle your best self in front of you in that way. You know, well, if you're going to be a hero, don't you want to do this? Yeah, if I'm going to be a hero, I do want to do that. And then you start to want to do that, you know? So again, it's like nobody's saying you've got to do this or you're in trouble. They're just asking a question. They're just giving you a prompt, and there's a carrot right there. And that carrot is everything you want for yourself as your entire identity in life.
Okay, so in Escape, we have Kent and we have some other contestants competing in a new game. This is not Survivor. This is a game you've created, Stephen Fishback. So just tell us the mechanics. How does this game Escape work?
Right. I mean, and honestly, Escape is even maybe more bare bones than Survivor. So Escape, you have eight contestants. They show up on a beach. They each get one tool. So someone has a machete. Someone has a fire starter. Someone has a tarp. And the eight of them have to choose what happens next. They can live together. They can go off into the jungle. But there's an island out at sea. And on that island is a treasure chest. And every day, more money gets added to that chest. So the contestants have to decide, how long can we live on this island, you know, together? Or should we try to take the chest now? Or, and should a group of us splinter off and betray the others? You know, you're right, it's not Survivor. I mean, that was very deliberate. On the one hand, I have a very, you know, lengthy and onerous contract with Survivor. But honestly, more than that, I Survivor was an amazing experience for me. And I didn't want this book to be read as an indictment of Survivor because, you know, to me, that is like the pure, perfect reality game. But you know, I wanted this game to be kind of a more pared back, intense confrontation with the wilderness. And partially because there are so many of these shows right now. You know, there's Naked and Afraid, there's Alone, there's Stranded with $1 Million, there's Man versus Wild, there's Dual Survival. You know, there's 100 shows that all have survival in their title. And I think there's something interesting about that. You know, like right now, at this moment in our world, like what is this obsession with this kind of like raw confrontation with nature about?
100%. I watch a lot of these shows and my husband and I sit in our comfortable living room criticizing the shelters people have built. Oh, I can't believe they went for an A-frame. I've never even slept in a tent, but there's something so appealing about seeing these people roughing it and surviving in these really basic elements.
Yeah. And I think it is because we're so comfortable, we're so cosseted, you know, we all have so, you know, so much in our lives. And the idea of kind of like just through these people on TV, this idea that we could go, you know, we're kind of like imagining ourselves back there on the beach and making choices and kind of like recapturing that sort of survival spirit.
Mm. So you've talked to us about your hero, Kent, this kind of washed up reality star who's going to return to play in this new game, Escape. Then there's our producer, Beck. When we meet her, her career's really in the toilet. She's been the producer for this reality show where she's kind of killed the dog. You want to tell us what's happened?
Yes. So Beck is a producer on this show called Surf Dogs. And this was, I just like love this idea. I mean, there is a whole like subculture of competitive dog surfing. I don't know if it's yet made its way to reality television, but she's kind of like at the margins of reality TV. You know, she's filming this like show on basic cable, but taking it very seriously. Like this is, you know, I have got to find the humanity of these dogs and their owners. And this has got to be my show, you know? And I think there's something like sort of sublimely absurd about that. But yes, this dog dies. And this was something that really upended her and kind of brings back some of her past issues.
And the thing that really, I guess, sets Beck apart is she's watching this dog die on a surfboard. And rather than rescue the dog, she keeps filming the dog because she has that producer's instinct to never stop filming.
Right. And that, I think, is her essential sin, is that she is so, you know, she doesn't see herself as an agent in the world. She is a producer. She is someone who is recording and observing and structuring. And like, she doesn't see herself as someone who can act.
Mm. So Stephen Fishback, you said you wanted to be a novelist before you even stepped foot on the beach in Survivor. Now, about 15 years later, you're here with your first novel. Was it always going to have to be about reality television?
Not at all. Honestly, I was writing a book about 20-somethings in New York, and I thought to myself, like, I actually have a more interesting story to tell here. You know, this story has been told, but I didn't feel like the story of reality TV right now had been told in a way that I felt was truly authentic and real. You know, I think we see these stories of reality contestants as, you know, fame whores and, you know, desperate for attention and very vapid. But that didn't correspond with the people that I knew or that, you know, I imagined I was, you know, people who are looking for this real authentic experience, you know, people who are like venturing out into this extreme environment, hoping for something big and meaningful themselves. And the way that that is both fulfilled and warped, I find really interesting. And then same too, I felt like I hadn't seen the story of the producers. You know, I think we have seen like the producers as these kind of manipulative puppet masters pulling the strings. But the way that the manipulation actually works, I thought was so interesting, just that how subtle and insidious it could be. And then two, just this idea that, you know, they're flawed people, desperate to write a story, to create a show. And in the pursuit of that goal, sometimes they do go too far.
Mm. This was a really fun read. It's called Escape. It's written by Stephen Fishback and it's published by Text. Stephen, how fun to meet you today.
Thank you so much. This was such a thrill and truly an honor to be here.
The book show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. It's made by me, Claire Nichols, and producer Sarah Lestrange. Come back next time for the iconic Australian writer Kathy Lett. Until then, happy reading.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.